Okay. Welcome to KDD once again. Sorry for last week. I was too sick to give the lecture. Sorry for that. I hope everybody read the mail before coming here and not after coming here. So everybody was at home at the time and not in this lecture hall. Regarding the lost time, we decided to not reduce the content of a lecture, but add an additional date for an extra lecture. However, this date is not set yet, and we will make sure that there's recording in that lecture, so everybody that isn't able to be here in person for that lecture will have a recording to look at. However, probably in 3 weeks, 4 weeks' time, not this week, not next week, but in some weeks' time. A positive note is that I changed my laser pointer, so now everybody should be able to see my pointer. I think that's good as well. We will restart at a point we stopped 2 weeks ago. So we will start at the slide measuring data similarity and dissimilarity of a data lecture. And we will today talk about the last slides of the data lecture, and then we'll go on with the pre-processing lecture. Okay, are there any questions without any regard to today's slides? Okay, then let's start. Okay, we already talked about what data is in general. Now we will have to talk about what data is compared to our data sets. And why do we need that? Because we need that similarity and dissimilarity in specific applications, specific methods like classification, like clustering, like outliers analysis. We will need specific measurement to classify whether two data sets or two data tuples are similar to each other or not similar to each other. And ideally, we do not want a binary scale, so it's identical and it's not identical, but we want to have a continuous measurement between the similarity of two slides. We will talk about each of these methods in later lectures. So classification will be part of lecture 7, clustering will be part of lecture 8, and outlier will be part of lecture 9. We will talk about those things later on in the semester. Therefore, I will skip the definition of clusters as well, because we will talk about that again in lecture 8. Now to similarity and dissimilarity. Of course, everybody has an opinion what similarity and dissimilarity is. For example, are you similar to your seat neighbor? Hard to measure. We need a specific definition of similarity to measure it. Similarity is defined as how alike two data objects are. In most cases, we will choose a value between 1 and 0 and 1, including 0 and 1. But in some cases, you will have other intervals as well. The higher the value is, the more alike, the more similar a value is, typically. Dissimilarity, on the other side, is often a synonym of distance. How far off are two data objects of each other? So, for example, if we have two points in a coordinate system, we have two dimensions. One dimension is h, and one dimension is salary. And we have person A here and person B here. dissimilarity would be the distance between those two data points. Of course, similarity and dissimilarity are closely related. However, dissimilarity is higher if similarity is lower. Typically, we will transform between those two just by using this is 1 minus sim. But this will be part of later lectures. Typically, we will have a minimum of 0 again, but in some cases, we will have another upper limit than 1. Because starting with a certain threshold, we might just say we are 0 similar. Another pretty important naming is proximity. Proximity can refer to both similarity and dissimilarity. So you always have to ask, once you read proximity, whether you will talk, you are talking about similarity or dissimilarity, because both are pretty different from each other. Negatively correlated, to be precise. We will talk about that later in the lecture, correlation. Okay, how to check dissimilarity? You might already know data matrices. Those are often used to store data objects or numbers in maths, of course. You will just have rows and columns. This is a pretty simple N to M data matrix shown here. This data matrix can be used to compute the similarity or dissimilarity between two different attributes. Because not two different attributes, but rather all attributes of a data set. Because you can then just check for the distance between x1 and x2. Distance x1, x3. So the first column is just comparing the attribute x1 with every other attribute. And the rows are comparing a specific attribute with another specific attribute. In this case, we are comparing xm with every x1. And therefore, you will get a similarity for every attribute, between every attribute. So let's say we will have attributes A, B, and C in our data set. And we have multiple values. Then a data similarity matrix is just comparing A with A. Of course, the distance or similarity between both is 1, the distance is 0, because both are equal to each other. Then we will compare A with B. We will have to compute this similarity. And AC, and the same for B with A, and so on. Of course, we will have to compute the similarity for each binary combination. This can be done with proximity measures. In this case, proximity measures is often a distance measure, so a dissimilarity measurement. Again, you should always ask whether we are talking about similarity or dissimilarity. In nominal attributes, we typically have just a binary measurement. Either the two values are the same, identical, when the distance is 0, or they are not the same, then we will have a distance of 1. So let's say, again, you and your seat neighbor are compared to each other. And we compare you two with your specific gender. Then you might be the same, male and male, or female and female, or you might be different, male and female, or male and whatever other gender you assume. That's pretty simple, because there's just two specific values. In this case, you can just compute for a whole combination of different attributes. So A with A, gender with gender, you can just compute the simple matching coefficient by just comparing the first tuple with the second tuple. So age with, gender with gender of the first and the second, of the first and the third, first and the fourth, and so on. And by simply adding that up as number of matching attributes and number of total attributes. So let's say we have three matching attributes and five total attributes. We will have a simple matching coefficient of 60%. This is pretty simple to do. It can be simplified again by using one-hot encoding. One-hot encoding is not only relevant for this part of the lecture, but for other methods as well. What is one-hot encoding? Let's say, again, we have this here. And let's stay with a binary, let's use three genders. So we have male, female, and diverse, okay? And male. One-hot encoding would create for every specific nominal possibility. So in this case, three possibilities, male, female, diverse, would create a specific extra attribute for that. So male, female, diverse. And would simply recode our data set by putting a one if the specific attribute is true and a zero if it isn't true for array attribute. So female would be coded as this, and diverse would be coded as this, and then again this one. This can simplify to compute, for example, the simple matching coefficient. However, it is needed in specific other methods, such as frequent pattern analysis as well. So if you hear about one-hot encoding, this is what is required of you. Why is it that easier to use? Because we can simply compare one with zero, and one with zero is zero. This is pretty simple to do. However, for binary attributes, we might have more advanced measurement of computing proximity. Again, we are computing dissimilarity, so distance. For this, we first need a so-called contingency table. A contingency table is just computing the counts of things. So let's again do a binary example. Let's cross out with diverse, and we're using male and female for binary attribute. Now we can create a contingency table. Where we just compare male. Sorry, that was wrong. We compare I have an example later on in the slides. Let's go with that example, then coming up with an example spontaneously. A specific contingency table is just, yeah, we have two states, in this case, 1 and 0. In my example, I try to start there. It would be male and female. And we just count up how often the positives, not the positives, in this case, in our case, the males match. So let's say we have 3 matching males, and how often the females match, that would be T. How often we have 1 attribute being male and 1 attribute being female, that would be R. And we have 1 and 0, so female and male, that would be S. It would be will be clearer once we get to the real example. We can create this contingency table to then apply a distance measurement to that. These two, we have 2 distance measurements. We have 1 for symmetrical attributes, where everything is identically or as important as every other attribute, that would be symmetrical. And asymmetrical would be 1 has specific other relevances. So in our example here, and that's the example I talked about, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 attributes. The attribute sex is symmetrical because the sex, there's no better sex or worse sex. They are both of equal importance. However, all other values are of asymmetrical relevance. So we have more better values and worse values. For example, having fever is worse than having no fever, I would say. Especially with my experience last week. So we have other relevances in this case. This is true for every other attribute in this data set. So sex would be symmetrical, and all other attributes are asymmetrical. And now we define that fever, cough, test 1, test 2, test 3, test 4. For fever and cough, we will use the values y and p to be equal to 1, and the value of n to be equal to 0. Why do we do that? Because this is hard to compare. However, if we use zeros and ones, we are easier to compare. Let's go back to our data set. And let's say we have on one side Bob. That's our one data object we want to compare. And we have, I forgot about Alice. And we want to compare those two. We have 1 and 0, and 1 and 0, okay? And now we take a look at our table. Fever, Bob and Alice are both at 1. Then cough, both at n, both at 1, both 0, both 0. So we have, in total, we have 2 times matching positives. This would be a 2. Because we have 2 times in the column fever, those attributes are matching, and in the column test 1, they are matching. Then negatives, matching zeros, we have in cough, we have in test 2, and in test 4. So in this cell, we put a 3 as a total count of negatives. And now we take a look at the only left column, test 3, where Bob is negative and Alice is positive. So we are in, Bob is negative, Alice is positive, we are here, we have a 1 here. And a 0, let's do it this way for better separation. So we have these contingency values. And now we can compute the distance using the distance measurement for asymmetrical binary variables. So this formula, R plus S divided through Q plus R plus S. And if we put that in, we will have this. So R is our top right value. Maybe I switched Bob and Alice around, but that's not important. So R and S, it's not important whether R and S are divided because both are in both sides and we can switch it up. So in our case, we have, let's do it this way. We have R plus S is 1 plus 0 divided through Q, which is top left, plus R plus S, which is equal to our value of 0, or roughly 0.33. It's not important whether you put Bob at the top and Alice at the left, or Bob at the left and Alice at the top, because it would match the same value. And by this, we know that the similarity between Bob and Alice for the asymmetrical attributes, important for the asymmetrical attributes, not for symmetrical attributes, is 0.33. Are those two similar to each other, or are they not similar? Or are they more similar than dissimilar to each other? Question. Any ideas? If this is a distance measurement, a distance measurement measures distance, so dissimilarity. The higher the distance measurement, the greater the dissimilarity is. Let's say we are in an interval of 0 to 1. Are we more on the similar side or more on the dissimilar side? Let's think about that at home, and we will talk about that next week. let's not do that. But we are below 0.5, and therefore we are more on the lower end of a dissimilarity measurement, so we are more similar. But this is relative to each other. Of course, you can say that totally. So this is distance. This is distance between Bob and Alice. And distance is negative, so the similarity would in most cases be and because that is above 0.5, we are more on the similar side than on the dissimilar side. Hopefully that's understandable. Are there any questions regarding that? Yeah?
So, like you could say, like, the less the distance between two points, the more they are similar.
Yeah. Let's take a look at that. The lower the distance between those two points is, the more similar they are. So the closer you are in age and salary, in this definition, of course, I wouldn't say human is defined by age and salary, but in this definition, the more similar two humans are. Okay. We have one problem, because we just talked about nominal attributes and binary attributes. But in the real world, we also have numerical values. And we might have numerical values that differ a lot. Let's again go with age and salary. Age may be 10, so zero salary. Then 30, salary might be, let's do yearly salary. Let's go with 40,000. And now let's be 50, and we earn 1 million. Okay? Of course, not realistical, but let's go with these values. We will see that the range of age is between 0 and 80. 0 and 100 is a realistical range for age, I would say. While the salary is between 0, earning nothing, and maybe even 5 billion, if you are Jeff Bezos or something like that. So we have hugely differing ranges. And that might be problematic in some cases where we compare numerical values. So if we compare Bob with Alice, so 1 and 2, and just compute with the average between deviations, then the salary is much more important than the age, because it has a higher range. It has a greater influence if you just calculate an average. And that can be solved by standardizing or normalizing, that's something we'll talk on later on, the numerical data sets. So bringing them to a similar range, or in this case, with the C-score normalization, which is also called standardization. So specifically, the C-score normalization is called standardization. We need not normalize the range between of the values, but we normalize the standard deviation of the values. There are specific methods that profit from these things being standardized. If we normalize the standard deviation, we will also not have these great influence differences between two different attributes. This can be done by just taking the value x, subtracting our population mean, so our mean for all values, and dividing through the standard deviation. And we will do that for every value in every column. Important, each column has its own population mean, and each column has its own standard deviation. But it's done for every column. And after we have done that, both columns are more similar to each other. Of course, they aren't identical. They still have the same meaning behind them. And this enables us to, for example, compare Bob with Alice by using one of the simplest distance measures. You can use just adding up all value. Maybe it's later on the slides. We have, maybe let's go with this first. How to compute the distance? The distance of two different numerical attributes is computed with this formula. You draw the eighth root of this formula, the sum of all values, and then the difference, the absolute difference between x and y. So you can compare 10 minus 30 plus 0 minus 30,000, and then you will use the eighth square root. What is the eighth square root? The eighth square root is the h square root is just a value set. Specifically, we have multiple specific distance measurements that are often used. H equal to 1 is called the Manhattan distance. The Manhattan distance is a city block distance. Let's go with our example here. The city block distance would be going here, and this is the total distance between the two points. So measuring the distance around a city block. The H2 norm is the Euclidean distance, also known as L2 norm, where we measure this distance. And the Minkowski distance is just a generalization of these two distances, because theoretically you can use other H values. However, in most cases, I will see Euclidean or Manhattan distance in the practice. Every other value is not that often used, and there has to be a specific value to reason to use them. And this is of course better if you then use the C-score normalization or any other mean of normalizing your data set. Because then the differences between those two are not that important. As you see, in this case, without standardization, the salary has a much bigger influence on the total difference distance than the age. With C-score normalization, this isn't true anymore. And if you now take a look at another data matrix, so we have point X and point X2 and attribute 1 and attribute 2, we compare these two with a Euclidean distance, we will get to 3.61. Distance, again, doesn't have, in all cases, an upper margin. Some have, some don't have. Euclidean and Manhattan do not have, or all Minkowski distances do not have an upper limit. So if you compare x1 and x2, we get to a distance of 3.61, which is higher than the distance between x1 and x3, which is 2.24. So in this case, you can at least say that x1 is more similar to x3 than to x2. Again, you have to convert similarity and dissimilarity between each other. I'm looking at you specifically because, we already talked about that. You can compute that those values using this formula, so the Euclidean distance, and it should be the same for the distance. I won't do that here because we now have to finish with the data lecture. I hope the different methods to compute distance, similarity and dissimilarity, dissimilarity is also called distance, are understandable, are clear. Are there any questions regarding both? Matrix. This example or? I do not understand the question. You compare, so for example, to get to the value of 361, this one, you will just to get to this value, you just use the formula. So you use this lower formula. So x1, x2 equals. And now you sum up for attribute 1, it's 1 minus 3. For attribute 2, it's 2 minus 5. And then you just, of course, this is squared, was the Manhattan distance. And you compute this, and you should get to the value of 361. Is that right? Let's recheck. Maybe I did switch something in here. So we have 2 times 2, and we have plus 9, and then we have to draw the square root of 361, roughly 361. Yeah, because the higher the distance, the more distance between A and B, the less similar those two are. Let's say let's add some values in here. Five. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Of course, these two values, A and C, have a lower distance and are more similar to each other than the values A and B, because both have a higher distance between each other. So distance and similarity are contrary to each other. Was that your question? I'm just, if that wasn't your question, try to rephrase it. But I try to answer questions as I understand them, not necessarily how they are asked. Okay, any other questions? So the question was basically, I would say, how to compute that, and whether distance and dissimilarity are contrary to each other. Then let's go to preprocessing. And again, I'm too slow, but that's not our problem. Data preprocessing. Now we learned about data in general. You know what kind of data are existing, and you know basic measurements for those data. For example, mean, median, and things like that. With data preprocessing, we now do the next step. We take a look at the data, we have taken a look at the data set, and we now want to prepare the data set for our specific method. Whatever our specific method is, we might need today take different preprocessing steps, because different methods need different preprocessing steps. Some methods might need one-hot encoding as a preprocessing step. That's also preprocessing. However, in most methods, we will need some way to clean our data, because in the real world, data contains messy data samples. I would phrase it like that. There are specific types of messy data we will talk about. We will have to integrate data to each other. Maybe data is in specific sources. Maybe we have a database and we have an Excel sheet. Then we, of course, have to integrate the data. We might need to reduce our data set, the size of our data set, because there are, for example, too much dimensions. If we have 500 different attributes, most methods will not work well with those counts of attributes. And there are specific methods to reduce the data set. This is also true for reducing the number of samples, not only the number of dimensions. This can be done as well. And the last step we are talking about, probably not today, but next week, is data transformation and data discretization. We will come to that, where we just take a look at continuous data sets, for example, or nearly continuous data sets, because in computers we do not have continuous data sets for real. There's no way to really have continuous data sets. Okay. First, why do we want to preprocess data? Of course, if a specific method needs a specific way of the data being aligned, or because of the data being incorrect or wrong, that's the measurement of accuracy, the measurement of completeness, if there isn't every sample. That's specifically important if we have a time series database, if we have a sensor measuring the temperature outside, and we measure the temperature continuously every 10 seconds between 9 a.m. and 12 a.m. And then, for some reason, the sensor has a failure and doesn't measure values between 1 p.m. and 2 p.m. and then again starts to measure. We have an incomplete data set. If we try to draw a curve of the temperature values, this might be a problem, that there are missing values in the data set. So completeness is also a measurement of data quality. We need consistent data sets. For example, we might have a gender column with some being M and F and some being male. And then we again have M. That wouldn't be consistent. Our method might have problems with that. Um, is it timely? Again, especially important if we have specific methods. For example, if we have a turbine, a wind turbine, measuring the current energy production. And our method just receives those values 3 weeks after the wind occurred, or the measurements are done, then we can't really predict the energy output for the next 10 minutes, because those are old. We need timely data for that. We need to know whether the data is trustworthy. Because if someone at age 15 is telling us that he or she earns $1 million a month, it might not be really trustworthy. There might be a problem with the believability of a data set. And there might also be a problem with the understandability. Let's say we have a data set name and A. And name is John and Shane. And here we have 13 and 15. Is this really understandable? Do you know what A is telling us? Is it maybe the time the person worked with us? Is it maybe his or her hourly salary? It can be a lot of things, and we do not know whether what this column A is telling us, because there's just numbers, and we at least know it might not be the yearly salary, because that would be stupid. But we can really understand the data. We need more information. And especially that problem is really common in the real world. You might remember Lucas from the first lecture, my colleague working with Siemens. Siemens has a lot of data of their gas turbines. And they collect a lot of their sensorial data, but they are labeled as shit. You do not know which column is measuring what. And to detect what column is what, we need specific methods to roughly estimate what this might be. That's what Lucas is working on, partially. So there are different dimensions of data quality, and we didn't yet talk about all, because there are that many dimensions of data similarity, data quality, that we couldn't even talk about half of them. But those are the most important. And to ensure that we have as accurate as possible data, as complete as possible data, as consistent as possible data, as timely as needed data, as believable as possible data, and as interpretable as possible data, we need preprocessing. These tasks are just a summary of what is to come, so let's go to what is to come. First step, data cleaning. Data might be dirty, might be messy, might contain incorrect, not trustable, or error data. And there are different kinds of messy data. For example, we might have incomplete data sets. Again, it might be that we have certain data values missing. We might also have some attributes missing. There might be not a temperature column within a local measurement, local weather measurement. Or we might have only aggregate data, so data that is already preprocessed, and we need the original data sets. Example, we have no occupation for someone, or we have no temperature values in a certain time interval, my example from earlier. This is a pretty easy to understand kind of dirty data, I would say. Then we have noisy data. Noisy data most often occurs with sensors. So we have sensors, and sensors are measuring values. And let's say we have a consistent temperature of 13 degrees Celsius outside. Then noise might be something like this, that we have sometimes small values being off. Those are not really wrong. Or I think that's too small for the upper rows. Or you have to tell me if you can't read something. I can't see that. Okay, we might have values that are a little bit off, that might occur sometimes. This is called noise. It most often occurs with sensors because electrical misfunctions, small misfunctions, might occur. It sometimes also occurs if you send data over a network because there might be some noise introduced right there as well. It most often occurs only with numerical data because with a normal data set, so a string, noise would be pretty obvious. If you have meme instead name, you might get the idea that there's something wrong. And you will need a lot of noise to do that. More significant and more common with all kinds of data are errors and outliers. Very important. Errors aren't equal to outliers, and outliers aren't equal to errors. They might look the same in the first moment. And an outlier might be an indication of an error, but is not necessarily an error. For example, let's go with scores, scores of whatever kind. We have the scores 2, 3, 0, 6, 1, 9, and then 9, 5. If you remember the interquartile range, then you might already see that 9, 5 is pretty much an outlier. This might be an indication of an error because depending on the scores might not even be possible. If we have only a score range between 0 and 10, 9, 5 is for sure an outlier and an error. But if a score range is between 1 and 100, it is possible that this outlier is still correct. So it's not an error, but just an outlier. We will always have to check our context. It's pretty obvious that a salary of minus 10 is an error, because who is working for a negative salary? That's not that often true. Again, example for context. This context should be known to everybody here. We might have some inconsistencies. Inconsistencies we already talked about male and M, female and F are good examples for inconsistencies. But also having a column age and a column birthday that aren't matching up is an inconsistency. Also having different rating systems, for example, the German grading system and the British grading system, or US grading system. I'm not sure if both are using A to E, but different grading systems might happen. These are pretty simple to solve, of course. Inconsistencies can be solved easily. It might also happen that we have values that are both. For example, if age and birthday aren't matching up, one of these is the combination of both is an inconsistency, But one of those values is an error, because it's obvious that an age and a birthday have to match. Otherwise, one is wrong. So you might have different kinds of dirty data at the same time for the same value. This is more on a list on what to look for, and you will solve those things differently. And then we have intentional mistakes, dirty data. If you take a survey or do a survey, perform a survey, most often the surveys are anonymous. So you do not want to give everybody the information who took that survey, took part in that survey. And especially in medical things, you will then use pseudonyms. If you, for example, just use John Doe as the name of everybody, or Jane Doe for every female, this is disguising, for example, the real name of a person, or it's disguising missing data. It's intentional, but still might be misleading for a real data science project. So we'll have to identify intentionally altered data. Let's go through them again in some speed, so we do not have to go through everything in detail again. Incomplete data is, of course, pretty simple. We might have problems with something. There might be data that isn't available. For example, we do not know our customer's income. And then we just do not enter the customer's income because we do not know that. We do not know your name. If you take a look at a KDD forum, some of you have a name attached to the questions. Some of you have only the IDM identifier attached to their name. That's missing data, at least in the context forum. In the backend, of course, your data is available. You have a lot of data that might be missing. In some cases, you might be able to infer the data set. For example, temperature data. You might assume a certain curve. For sure. But with normal data, it's hard to infer data. How can I assume your name using the IDM identifier? I can't do that. So how can we handle this missing data? We can simply ignore the tuple, so remove it from our data set in pre-processing, or we can ask an expert, someone who knows the names for every IDM identifier, or we use an automatical process, for example, assuming curve for temperatures, or putting a constant into every value. There are different methods to do that. For example, we also might use a decision tree, which is a method of classification, which is something we will talk later on the semester. With noisy data, we have a random error, a small random error, which leads to slightly incorrect attribute values. Again, due to certain technical faults. How can we solve that? We can use binning, which is something we will talk about at the end of this slide set, not at the end of this lecture, probably. We might use regression, which is pretty simple to do. We might use clustering later in the lecture series, not in this lecture slides. Or we use a combination of humans and, again, methods. Data cleaning as a process. How do we do data cleaning? First of all, we have to detect that there's dirty data. We have to see the dirty data. Because if we do not know that there's a problem, we can't solve the problem. This can be done automatically. For example, using metadata to identify trustworthy and non-trustworthy sources. But it can also be done with some commercial tools. For example, we can do data scrubbing, which is a method where we use domain knowledge. So we, again, need an expert giving us domain knowledge, or an expert system having a name, domain knowledge, for example, about available postal codes. That is identifying if something isn't in the range of available postal codes. Let's say we have a postal code entered by a customer of 3 million in Germany. The postal code 3 million doesn't exist in Germany. We always have 5 numbers for a postal code in Germany. By just knowing that, we can identify possible errors, because if something is more or less than 5 numbers, then there's an error. We can go one step further, because not every 5 number, parts number is really existing in Germany. If we have a list of all available postal codes or all used postal codes, we can check for that as well. We can go one step further and having a system that also knows the cities associated to the postal code and just take a look at inconsistencies between those two. So maybe you have a correct postal code, but with a wrong city, we identified an inconsistency automatically. But we need domain knowledge for that. If you do not have domain knowledge, you aren't able to do that. You can also do data auditing, where you try to take a look at the existing data and try to discover rules and relationships to detect violations. A very simple method of detecting possible problems by data auditing is outlier detection. Because if we use the interquartile range to detect outliers, and there are some values outside this range, or 1.5 times this range, of course, then it's for sure an outlier, and as we learned, an outlier might be an error. This is one of the simplest methods of detecting possible data auditing and detecting possible errors. And we can do these methods live. We can do them during the introduction of data, but we can also do that with an existing data set we just want to pre-process. Most often, they are done automatically, because the earlier we detect data that isn't correct, the better for us, because we're easier to solve. If we detect a wrong postal code while the customer is entering his or her data, we can solve that within seconds, because we just show them a pop-up, postal code is wrong, please enter a correct one. And he or she does that for us. If we detect it after 3 years, and now we want to do some analysis on this data set, there's no real way to solve that value other than ignoring the tuple, because we can't go back to this customer and ask him or her, you entered the wrong postal code 3 years ago, please enter the correct one. He or she might not do that, or most likely will not do that. So the earlier, the better, but it can be used later on as well. And we also might want to use data migration, data integration, to transform our data set. Maybe we have a huge data amount generated by our gas turbine, again Siemens. Then we can transform, aggregate our data before storing it long term to save some storage space. It's not that common to transform data to be less or to aggregate it very aggressively, because in the business world, at least now, there's a lot of hope that you can use data later on. And therefore, and storage space is cheap, so you just store everything. But you can also transform data by adding a more easy to read attribute name. So no one has to worry about what sensor is shown, or what value is shown here in A. This is something you can do. And there's a ETL, extraction, transformation, loading process, which we will talk about in the OLAP lecture. So again, later in the semester. We can, of course, combine this automatical and this manual, or more or less manual process as well. Okay, data integration. Next start. Well, more or less what we are talking about here, but in greater detail. Data integration. Combining two different data sources into a coherent store. I used the example of Excel and a database, for example, but we might also have two different sensor systems. Or we have our customer creating an account and our business department creating the customer as well. To do that, we can use different methods. For example, not methods, but we have to do certain things. For example, we might have a problem that our customer ID in our first data source isn't equal to our data customer identifier in the second database or in the Excel sheet. If that's true, we have to match those two. Not necessarily putting the customer ID of the first data set in the second data set, because it might be used in that data set for another entity. But we at least have to identify that those two entities are the same and have to put a note somewhere saying, hey, customer ID 1 in data set A is equal to customer ID 35 in data set B. Of course, this has to be identified. How can we identify that? We can, for example, first of all, we can ask experts. If someone knows about that, no worries. If you know that someone already knows customer one and knows the Excel sheet and can tell us what is used, no problem. However, in some cases, we will have problems identifying that. And then we, for example, can get possibilities by using distance measurements. A distance measurement on names, for example. We can check for Bill Clinton and William Clinton have the same surname, last name. So they are likely to be similar to each other. However, the first names in our data set, Bill and William, aren't the same. Hard to solve. But if you know, those two might be the same because Sometimes Bill Clinton was called William Clinton. This is hard to do. And knows at least some domain knowledge. You know, need to know, have at least some domain knowledge, and then can enter that into a system that is using distance measurements. But it's, a real workload heavy task. Easier to solve is redundancy. If we have two times exactly the same data in both data sets, this is easy to identify. If you already know customer ID 1 and customer ID 45 are the same in both data sets. And now in both data sets, we have the address of the customer, which is already identified as the same person. Then we have redundant information. We already know that both are the same. Why save it in two cases? This is, we have costing storage space and also a probable source of inconsistencies later on, because maybe the customer changes his or her address and it's only changed in one source. So we just want to integrate both together, remove the redundancy to avoid things like that. Redundant attributes are easy to identify with correlation analysis, and therefore also covariance analysis, which is something we will talk about now. What is a correlation analysis? If we want to identify correlation, so there are two attributes in this case, correlate with each other. Correlation is nothing less but if attribute, let's use another table to not be that small. If we have A, if we have one curve of light vags and one is this. So we have A and B. We know that both are probably not correlated with each other. But if B is this and A is this, then we have a high correlation. Both are increasing together and decreasing together. Not necessarily at the same values, but decreasing and increasing together. And also, these two are correlated. One is negative, they are correlated negatively. One is rising if the other one is decreasing. And of course, we can do that with numerical and nominal data. In this case, we want to know whether someone who is reading books is also likely to play chess. That's correlation. So whether it's these two attributes are correlated. This can be done with a correlation analysis for normal data. A lot of things to be seen on that slide. I will go through that. Let's do it in general first. When we have two attributes, A and B, to analyze, and we know that A has n distinct values in this example would be Y and M, and B has M distinct values, again, Y and N, I've already also written that down here. We can then take a look at the set of all distinct combinations. So all combinations that are given in the dataset. Combinations are, for example, y, and n and y, and n and n. So all four combinations are given. And the multiset y of all tuples, multiset, because we have multiple times the same values, 1 and 2 wouldn't be possible to be coexist in a set because it's the same combination, which is just the data set. The multiset y is just the data set. We get these four values. So we have y and n, the four possible combinations, and the 1,500 total tuples in the data set. And now we can use a formula, which is again using a contingency table. We already talked about contingency tables earlier today. And in this contingency table, we do have two different values. We have an actual quantity in y. Sorry for that, but I'm confused. But we have actual quantity in y, which is just counting, summing up how often a specific combination is occurring in our data set. And we have an expected quantity, how often it would be if we have no correlation at all in case of independence. Let's do that for our example. We just combine the different values, A with all different values. In our case, we only have two values, plays chess and doesn't play chess, so Y and N. And we have read books and doesn't read books. Now we take a look at, we count how often we have a combination of plays chess and reads books in our dataset. By just taking a look at that dataset, because there are a lot of tuples not within that, within our slide. But let's say we have 250 different combinations, tuples with plays chess and reads books, both being Y. 250. Doesn't play chess and reads books is present 200 times. Doesn't read books and plays chess is present 50 times. And both N is present 1,000 times. Those are the real values, C. So the values we actually can count in our data set. The next part is to compute the expected quantity if we have no correlation at all. This can be done by using the formula. As we have already have the values C, we can just put them into this formula. So summing up every value where the attribute is true, divided through the count of total attributes, and so on. And then we get to the expected values of 90, 210, 360, 840. Important, per column and per row, the sum for both expected and actual quantity is the same because of that formula. In this formula, we just take a look at the values where we have the same value and where we do not have the same value. And therefore, we get to the same count, total count. And now we can use the chi-squared test. Chi-squared, chi is a Greek letter, on this dataset, where we just use our contingency table again and compare the real values with the expected values for every cell of a contingency table. And if we do not have correlation, or we have nearly no correlation, we are going with a chi squared value towards zero. The higher the chi squared value, the more likely we have correlation. Of course, if we have a value like in Reed's books, where the real value and the expected value differ a lot, this increases the chi squared total. So the higher the difference between the expected and the real value, of course, the higher the correlation. Of course, the higher the value, the less correlation. For our example, we have chi squared value of 507, which is not very close to zero, therefore we are correlated. Very important thing to note is correlation. So we know that someone who reads books is likely to play chess. Something very important to note is that correlation isn't equal to causation. So you can't say that someone who reads books is likely to play chess because he or she is playing chess. This is not the reason why this is likely. I opened up a little website which I find useful to show that that correlation and causation aren't really the same, because they have a lot of examples showing that causation and correlation can't be the same. For example, if we take a look at the distance between Saturn and the Sun, it's changing, of course, over time. And Google searches of how to make a baby, they correlate a lot of, like shown in this data set. They do not have any causation at all. Of course, why should that be important? We have Tom Scott's videos, and there are a lot of examples on this site, spurious correlations, if you're interested in that. It's just to show you causation and correlation aren't the same. This is very important to note. And a high correlation or correlation, two attributes correlating with each other, can be an indication of some causation happening, but isn't the proof, the definitive proof of causation between two attributes. Let's say it this way. That's an important part. Are there any questions regarding nominal data, correlation analysis for nominal data? It's just using the formula. You can do that. At least try to use the formula to use these values at home. In our exercise sheet, we also have an example for analysis like that. So you will have a look at that once again in the exercise sheets. Let's go to numerical data, because while nominal data has no value to the specific things in that. Yes and no of playing chess. What is better, what is worse? There's no meaning to that. However, with numerical values, we have exactly what is shown here. We can say that increasing values, if both values are increasing at the same time, we more likely are correlated. And therefore, we need another formula to compute correlation in numerical attributes. And that's done with the Pearson's product moment coefficient. The Pearson's product moment coefficient is pretty basic again. It's just using a formula. And I will not go into detail on how this formula is created, but yeah, you just need to know how to use it. If we have, again, two attributes A and B, maybe this example here shown in the graph, then we can just take a look at the sum of the concrete ith value, so the first value, the second value, the third value, the fourth value, and so on, of A minus the mean value of A, important mean value of a column A, so again, per column, times the concrete value of B minus the mean of a column B. And then divided through the total count of attributes and the standard deviations of A and B. And this is telling us if A and B are if the Pearson's product moment coefficient gets to zero, that A and B are independent. So they are not correlated. Again, zero, no, no correlation, like with the chi-squared test. And if it's positive, they are positively correlated. Of course, the higher the value, the more correlation. And if it's negative, we have negatively correlation. So compared to chi-squared, which is always positive, we can go into the negative, but we can have, can't have something like this with negative correlation in the nominal attributes, because there's no implicit meaning to nominal attributes. There's no better or worse in nominal attributes. So this is only possible with numerical attributes, or at least ordered attributes with an order behind them. I implicitly already show you, have shown you the method or how to detect, visually detect numerical correlation, because if, and now that was what I have tried to draw beforehand. If we draw the values of both attributes not in a timeline, but in an axis for itself. So here's the value for A, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. This is only possible with time series, not this is possible with every attribute, or at least ordered. This is possible with everything. And we simply draw the different tuples in here. So the tuple with value 2 at A and 1 at B, and 1 here, 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 we get to a positive correlation because both are increasing at the same time. If there's no clear trend visible, then we have no correlation. And if we have a line going down, we have negative correlation because one is increasing, x is increasing, y is decreasing. Negative correlation, like here with time series. So here we have the time or the order. And this is only working with time attached to every attribute. Okay, example for that. We do not have to go through it in detail because it's again just entering every value within the formula, but basically we have again the sum of A minus B and so on. So we get to this value. 4 is above, is a positive value, so we have positive correlation. Yeah, and I think that's a good point on for ending this lecture. Are there any questions regarding the lecture until now? Again, we will resume the lecture next week. Yeah, question. Okay, whether there's any linkage between similarity and correlation. Not really, because you might have two attributes that are very distant to each other. So for example, age and salary. Both have a great distance between each other, but they, in most cases, correlate with each other. But of course, in some specific cases, you might have things that are very closely to each other, and this might happen. And in most cases, it might happen, but yeah, it's not definitive, definite. Okay, yeah, I guess. Have a great day.